Welcome to the debate.
Good to be here.
Today we are dissecting a legal battle that really pits the physical pain of two women in California against the full unyielding weight of the United States federal government. The case is Gonzalez v. Reich, decided back in 2005.
And this is one of those cases that sounds small on paper, you know, six marijuana plants and a suburban backyard, but the implications are just massive. It basically asks, is there anything the federal government cannot do? Or has the Constitution's Commerce Clause effectively become a blank check for Congress?
The facts are straightforward, but they're heavy. You had Ava Reich and Diane Monson. Both were Californians. Both were suffering from severe, debilitating medical conditions. We're talking inoperable brain tumors, chronic wasting syndrome, severe pain. Under California's Compassionate Use Act, they were doing everything right. They were growing marijuana for personal medical use with a doctor's recommendation to manage that pain.
Right, and let's be very clear about the activity here. No selling, no crossing state lines, no advertising. This was just homegrown medicine to survive the day. But the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, they didn't care about California law. They raided Monson's home. They seized and destroyed her plants. Their justification was that under the Federal Controlled Substances Act, or CSA, marijuana is a Schedule I drug. Illegal to possess, illegal to grow, period. End of story.
And that collision sets up our central question today. Does the Constitution's Commerce Clause, which explicitly gives Congress the power to regulate commerce among the several states, empower them to ban a plant grown in a backyard for personal use that never leaves the property?
And I argue it absolutely does not. I think Reich was wrongly decided. It just obliterated the necessary distinction between what is local and what is national. It betrayed the Federalist Revolution the court had started just a few years earlier in United States v. Lopez, and it left the 10th Amendment, well, hanging by a thread.
And I take the opposing view. Reich was rightly decided. It was a necessary application of the Constitution to the realities of a modern interconnected economy. If Congress has the power to regulate the interstate drug market, which almost no one denies they do, it must have the necessary and proper power to regulate local activities that threaten to undercut that market. You can't regulate a market if you can't police the supply chain, even the local parts of it.
Well, let's dig into that threat. Because to me, the leap from regulating interstate commerce to policing a sick woman's garden requires some incredible mental gymnastics.
I think it requires looking at the substantial effects doctrine. And honestly, to understand Reich, we have to go back to 1942 and meet a farmer named Roscoe Filburn.
Ah, the infamous Wickard v. Filburn. You really can't discuss federal power without talking about Roscoe's wheat.
Exactly. This is the bedrock precedent. Filburn was a wheat farmer in Ohio. The federal government had set strict quotas on how much wheat farmers could grow, aiming to stabilize prices during the Great Depression. Filburn grew more than his quota allowed. But, and this is the key defense he raised, he argued that the excess wheat wasn't for sale. He was feeding it to his own livestock and, you know, using it for bread for his family. He said, "This is local. It never leaves my farm. You can't regulate it because it's not commerce."
And the court disagreed.
They did. They established what we call the aggregation principle. They said, sure, Filburn's wheat is a drop in the bucket, but if everyone did what Filburn did, if every farmer grew their own wheat instead of buying it, the national market would collapse. Filburn's home consumption substituted for a market purchase. He wasn't buying wheat because he was growing it.
And that's the logic they apply to Angel Reich.
It is. The court viewed marijuana as a fungible commodity, just like wheat. If Reich grows it at home, she isn't buying it on the market. If you aggregate that activity across thousands or millions of people, it has a substantial effect on the supply and demand of the national drug market.
Okay, but hold on. I see why you think that, but let me offer a different perspective. There is a massive distinction here that the court in Reich just completely glossed over. Roscoe Filburn was a commercial farmer. He was already operating in the interstate wheat market. He just held some inventory back. He was a businessman. Angel Reich and Diane Monson were not commercial actors. There was no transaction. There was no money changing hands.
But does commerce require money, or does it require economic activity?
I would argue it requires commerce, trade, exchange. If growing a plant for your own pain relief is commerce, then the word has lost all meaning. And this is where I think Raich really betrayed the precedent set in United States v. Lopez.
Okay, let's clarify Lopez for the listeners, because that was the real pivot point before Raich.
Right. So Lopez, decided in 1995, involved the Gun-Free School Zones Act. A student brought a gun to school. He was charged under federal law. The Supreme Court struck that law down. They said, possessing a gun near a school is a criminal act, sure, but it is not an economic one. It doesn't involve buying or selling. The court finally drew a line in the sand. They said, Congress, you can't just regulate everything by claiming it indirectly affects the economy. They said there has to be a distinction between what is truly commercial and what is non-economic. Raich essentially erased that line.
I disagree. The line wasn't erased, it was clarified. The distinction is between economic and non-economic activity. In Lopez, holding a gun is not economic. You aren't producing anything. You aren't trading anything. But in Raich, we are talking about cultivation.
Gardening.
Production. If I build a table, I have produced a good. If I grow a crop, I have produced a commodity. Production is inherently an economic act because it creates something with market value. That's why Raich falls on the Wickard side of the line, not the Lopez side. The court wasn't being inconsistent. They were categorizing the activity of growing as production.
That is a compelling argument. But have you considered the implications of defining economic that broadly? I mean, if growing six plants for personal use is production and therefore interstate commerce, what isn't? If I grow a tomato in my backyard for a salad, is that interstate commerce? If I knit a sweater for my grandson instead of buying one at a department store, am I impacting the international textile market?
In the aggregate, yes, you are. If everyone knit their own sweaters, the sweater industry would crash.
But that's the apocalypse scenario. That's exactly what the legal scholars warned about in the older cases like Hammer v. Degenhart. If the federal government can regulate my knitting because it competes with a factory in China, then the federal government has a general police power. They can regulate anything inside my home. And the Constitution explicitly denied them that. The founders listed specific powers for a reason.
I think you're engaging in a bit of a slippery slope argument. The court isn't coming for your sweater.
Not yet, but the legal logic allows for it.
The court in Raich focused on the fact that Congress had established a comprehensive scheme. This is the Controlled Substances Act. The goal was to extinguish the interstate market for illicit drugs. The court ruled that under the Necessary and Proper Clause, Congress can regulate local activities if, and this is the crucial phrase, if failing to regulate them would leave a gaping hole in the regulatory scheme.
This is the leakage argument, right?
Exactly. It's rational to believe that high demand for marijuana means homegrown supplies will inevitably leak into the interstate market. You can't distinguish homegrown pot from illicit pot once it leaves the garden. If you create a massive loophole for personal use, you effectively make federal enforcement impossible. I mean, the police pull someone over with a bag of marijuana, and the person just says, oh, I grew this at home. How do you disprove that?
But that argument is a bootstrap. You're essentially saying if Congress creates a big enough bureaucracy, a comprehensive enough scheme, they can regulate any local activity just by claiming it's necessary to protect the scheme.
If the scheme itself is valid, yes.
But that allows Congress to pile unconstitutional provisions together with constitutional ones and say, well, it's all part of the package. Justice O'Connor pointed this out in her dissent. She saw that this logic gives Congress a superpower. Just write a bigger law, and you don't need to worry about the Constitution anymore. It turns the concept of limited government on its head.
It's not about writing a bigger law just for the sake of it. It's about the reality of the market. We are one nation with one economy. Drugs don't stop at state lines. California can't just opt out of federal law because they want to run a laboratory of democracy.
But the laboratories of democracy are exactly what the federal system is designed for. Justice Brandeis was famous for this idea. California wanted to try a different approach to medical marijuana, treating it as a health issue, not a crime. If it fails, the damage is local to California. If it succeeds, other states can copy it. Raich says no, no experimentation allowed if Congress disagrees.
But under the Supremacy Clause of Article VI, federal law wins. That's basic constitutional law.
Only if the federal law is constitutional in the first place. You can't use the Supremacy Clause to justify a law that exceeds Congress's powers.
You have to prove Congress has the power first.
And that brings us right back to the Necessary and Proper Clause. McCulloch v. Maryland, way back in 1819, taught us that necessary doesn't mean absolutely impossible to do without. It means conducive, useful, conducive. Regulating Angel Reich's plants was conducive to enforcing the total ban on marijuana.
Conducive. That is such a low bar. Let's test this limit. In the source material, there's a hypothetical called the Electric Shock Act.
Ah, I was wondering if you'd bring up the buzzers.
It sounds absurd, but just follow the logic. Daydreaming in class lowers student productivity. Lower productivity eventually hurts the national GDP. Therefore, in the aggregate, daydreaming has a substantial effect on interstate commerce. Under the logic of Reich and this broad definition of economic effect, could Congress mandate that every student chair have a buzzer to shock them if they daydream?
It's a vivid image, but it fails legally. Daydreaming is not an economic activity. It's not production, distribution, or consumption of commodities.
But isn't it? You said earlier that production is economic. Well, education produces workers. If I'm not paying attention, I'm producing a worse worker. If economic just means anything that links to the market, then daydreaming is absolutely economic.
I think the court has been careful to limit this. Look at United States v. Morrison. That was the Violence Against Women Act case, decided in 2000. The government argued that gender-motivated violence cost the economy billions in medical bills and lost work. It clearly affects the economy, but the court said no. They struck it down because violence is not in itself an economic act.
They did say that in Morrison, but then you look at United States v. Taylor. A guy robs a local drug dealer of a cell phone and a little bit of weed. The court said that robbery was a federal crime under the Commerce Clause because it affected the business of drug dealing. So robbery of the drug dealer is economic, but sexual assault is non-economic? The distinction feels arbitrary. It feels like the court just picks the outcome they want based on policy preference.
I think Taylor fits perfectly. Robbery targets the inventory of a business, even an illegal one. It interferes with trade. Violence against women targets a person, not a commercial enterprise. The distinction holds up. And in Reich, we are dealing with a commodity. Marijuana is a tangible good that is bought and sold.
But Reich wasn't selling. I keep coming back to this. She was a patient.
And here is where the court's deference comes in. The court uses the rational basis test. They don't have to agree that Reich is necessary. They just have to ask, was it rational for Congress to conclude that local cultivation threatens the interstate ban?
And that is the problem. Rational basis is practically no test at all. It basically asks, was Congress hallucinating? If the answer is no, the law stands. It removes the judiciary from the equation. In Lopez, the court actually looked at the evidence and said, the link is too weak. In Reich, they just reverted to trusting Congress.
Because judges aren't economists. If Congress looks at the complex web of drug trade and says, we need to plug this hole to make the dam hold, who is the Supreme Court to say? No, that hole is too small to matter. That's judicial activism.
No, that's judicial review. They are the guardians of the Constitution. If they don't draw the line, nobody will. And this brings me to the 10th Amendment. The powers not delegated to the United States are reserved to the states.
And the court addressed that. They cited United States versus Darby, calling the 10th Amendment a truism.
A truism? That phrase haunts me.
It just means that the amendment is self-evident. It says, if Congress doesn't have the power, the states do. But if Congress does have the power, and the court found they do under the Commerce Clause combined with the Necessary and Proper Clause, then the 10th Amendment doesn't block it. The 10th Amendment isn't a shield against valid federal power. It's just a reminder of the structure.
But by treating it as a truism, and by expanding commerce to include homegrown medicine, the court has effectively given Congress general police power. The only limit left is what Congress chooses not to regulate.
I think you're ignoring the jurisdictional hook aspect. In many federal laws, they have to prove the specific item crossed state lines. This gun moved from Texas to Oklahoma. That limits the power.
Right. That's the hook.
The CSA, the drug law, doesn't have that hook. And the court said it didn't need one. Why? Because the scheme is comprehensive. When you regulate a whole market, you don't need to check every single tomato or marijuana plant for a passport. That is simply how you make government function in a complex world. You regulate the class of activities, not the individual item.
Or it's how you create a government that is unaccountable to the limits of its own charter. You know, it is worth noting that even Justice Scalia, usually a strict text guy, sided with the majority here.
He did. Justice Scalia wrote a concurrence relying heavily on the necessary and proper clause. He argued that even if the activity isn't commerce itself, regulating it is necessary to make the regulation of interstate commerce effective.
Which I find fascinating.
It shows that this isn't just a liberal big government idea. It's a practical legal reality. Scalia realized you can't have a half measure on drug enforcement.
Or it shows that when it comes to the war on drugs, principles go out the window. Everyone gets scared of looking soft on crime. So the Commerce Clause gets stretched like a rubber band. You could argue Scalia was willing to sacrifice federalism to save the drug war.
Well, that's a cynical view. I think he saw the logical consistency of Wickard. If you accept we have a national economy, you have to accept national regulation.
But let's look at the reality of Ms. Monson and Ms. Reich one last time. Monson had her plants destroyed. She wasn't a drug kingpin. She wasn't moving product to Nevada. The application of this vast federal power on her specific, local, non-economic act feels like a gross overreach. It feels like the police power that the states were supposed to retain.
It is a tragedy for her, certainly. But constitutional law deals with the scope of power, not just the sympathy we feel for a litigant. If we carve out an exception for her, we carve out an exception for the next person who claims their 500 plants are for personal use.
500 plants is different from six.
Is it? Legally, where do you draw the line? That's why the court defers to Congress. Congress draws the line.
And I maintain that the Constitution drew the line at commerce among the several states, not gardening in a backyard.
We are nearing the end of our time, so let's try to land this plane.
Sure.
From my perspective, Gonzalez v. Reich was the correct call. It prevented a massive loophole in the Controlled Substances Act. It reaffirmed that we have one national economy. And when Congress decides to regulate a market, even an illicit one, they have the power to reach local activities that threaten that regulation. It upholds the legacy of Wickard and the practical application of the Necessary and Proper Clause.
And from my side, Reich was a failure of judicial nerve. It was a missed opportunity to enforce the boundaries of federalism. By labeling homegrown medicine as economic production, the court allowed the federal government to override the democratic choices of states like California. It weakened the 10th Amendment and signaled that the Federalist Revolution of Lopez was essentially over.
It suggests that if Congress can dream up a rational reason, they can reach into your backyard garden.
It really illustrates the tension between the modern interconnected world we live in, where everything affects everything else, and the original constitutional design of limited, enumerated powers.
Exactly. We want a government that can solve big problems, but we also want a government that stays out of our local affairs. And Reich suggests we can't have both.
A dilemma for the ages. Thanks for joining the debate.
Always a pleasure.